presenting a bold new adventure into Lovecraftian horror and black comedy. The Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program's acclaimed second series, The Terrible Secret of Lot X.
This is startling and strange, but darling, we might be onto something here. This is why we came to Arkham, after all.
The Necronomicon. Whatever your intent with this book, you will find more danger than answers.
In this program, our cast actually lives the terror.
The air gives way to the crushing depths. You're drowning. You're drowning in a sea of yellow.
It's an improvised audio drama that uses Chaosium's Call of Cthulhu role-playing game and the wits of our players. These poor souls never know what's going to crawl out of the darkness. Just search for the Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program or unlock all our secrets at CthulhuMystery.com.
Consequence Podcast Network.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you. But if you want to make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you. All in the name of hope. All in the name of hope. All in the name of
greetings, constant listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast presented by Consequence Podcast Network. I'm your host, Editor-in-Chief Michael Rothman, and this is a special day. This is a day that we've been waiting for a very, very long time, because we're going back to Derry, or we're going to almost go back to Derry. We got, finally, the teaser trailer for It, Chapter 2, and while that doesn't hit theaters until September 6th, which we accurately stated multiple times in the recent Steeple Tweets episode. We got one hell of a teaser trailer. We're going to be breaking it down for you today, but I'm not alone. And actually, I am alone because I'm alone in the studio, but I'm not alone here on our call. And we have two fellow losers here, and they're all in separate states. And let's go to Tennessee first.
Yeah. Hey, it's me. It's Rockin' Randall Colburn. I am here staring out at the beautiful mountains of Gatlinburg, Tennessee, where I am on vacation with my wife and several of her old college friends. And we spent a nice day, out in the wilderness, things of that nature. And back now to talk King.
Nice. Let me go over to Missouri. Or no, is it Iowa?
Oh, my God. Iowa City is the name of the town.
I know. Iowa. Who is that?
This is Mel Castle. I'm in Iowa City, as has been my wont for a while now. You'll have to pardon my less than mellifluous voice today. I'm just getting over a quick cold. I'm staring at my pets who are trying to dismantle what looks like a bunch of plastic wrap under the desk. So no mountains here, but... there's still entertainment to be had in good old Iowa City. I gave my students their final today. My general education literature students had some questions about Carrie on there because we read it this semester.
Nice.
So yeah, I got some King converts in the classroom.
What were the questions?
Did they like it?
They loved it. Yeah, they really, really liked it. Let me try and remember. One was just about the nature of like the TK gene. There's a great amount of like weird science in Carrie about how the telekinesis gene is like passed down, which I sort of forgot about. And we talk a lot about how it's an epistolary novel like Dracula, which was our first novel that we read. So it's always cool to compare the different techniques in a novel written in the late 1800s and then King's like 1970 epistolary novel. Pretty cool.
Yeah, I actually read Carrie in college for women in literature, it was taught by a woman, but she had fully admitted that I was like, yes, I know that Stephen King is a man and wrote this book, but I actually feel that this is a very strong female character and the way that he writes it. And so it was interesting. So we had Carrie right next to Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House and a few other novels that we
did that one too. I just redid your whole course.
Yeah. She was really cool too. I think she was Wiccan. So it was
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, Mel, did you tell your students you're on a Stephen King podcast?
I told one because she asked me how big of a Stephen King fan I was because she's a huge Stephen King fan. And I said, I'm such a big Stephen King fan that I'm on a podcast. Maybe she does now. I don't know.
She better. You should have made it part of her grade.
I try to put a very indestructible wall between my personal life and the lives of my students, Randall.
I was going to say, one of the guys here is a teacher, and he was talking about like various things that his students have found that he's done online, you know, like nothing too bad, but like old YouTube videos and stuff. And it just made me think about like the horrors that my students would dig up if I were teaching these.
It's a lot. If you Google me, my Twitter account comes up pretty quickly. And like, I don't know, I swear on there.
Yeah.
Well, you swear on here too.
You also always.
I sure fucking do.
You're also always posting videos of you like beating up animals and stuff. So.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but never any animals that I know. They're always strangers.
Well, I just remember in the Cujo episode, you're like, I just recently put down a dog and cut off its head and I kept the head. So
if you
that's
listen
all
to our Cujo
record.
Episode, listeners, you'll find that that's a blatant exaggeration.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah. So should we start with the It trailer? We have a few things we're going to discuss today.
Yeah, let's do some house chores first. So basically, we got two stories that we want to basically just discuss real quick before we get into the main event, which is obviously It Chapter 2. But there are two big things that happened in the past few weeks that since you've last heard us. The first
number one.
Yes, the first is Salem's Lot. We're getting a Salem's Lot movie.
Mike, you don't sound too excited.
Well,
I don't think any of us.
No,
that was elated to some opinion.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it basically is a bummer because this is one of the most anticipated adaptations. I was, you know, going into this Stephen King Renaissance and I just have not been very excited about anything involving Gary Dauberman, which is funny because we're going to be talking about something today, obviously with It Chapter 2. You know, involving Gary Dauberman, but oof, The Nun is awful. You know, yeah. just well, really, really bad. And ugh.
I know. And that's sort of the thing is like, I don't dislike the Conjuring universe movies, although I haven't seen The Nun yet, but you know, the Conjuring universe is sort of spearheaded by James Wan and Gary Dauberman has proven himself to be like a, you know, one of the main writers of that whole franchise. Plus he's directing the next Annabelle movie. And so, like basically those two guys are sort of the architects of the Conjuring universe. Mm-hmm. So that they've, or at least Wan is scooped up Tommyknockers, and Dauberman's obviously got his fingers in several of Stephen King's properties, and now both of them are working on Salem's Lot. You know, it's just, the thing is, I'm fine with the Conjuring movies on their own. I see them as very, like, I don't know, fine horror movies that are fine, but it's like, you know, Salem's Lot, you want to be something good, and they make kind of really slick studio horror. Yeah. You know. Yeah. Like stuff that's really daring, stuff that doesn't really, I don't know. It's not exciting. It's not trailblazing. And it's not, you know, it doesn't, and it all kind of looks the same. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like,
yeah, exactly.
They have like a really defined mainstream horror slick aesthetic. And that to me does not feel like it would transfer to Salem's Lot, which is to me sort of a very quirky story. I mean,
if you're bad enough to fuck up Catholic horror, which is one of the best and easiest niche genres to do.
Yeah.
Like I'm a little worried.
Yeah. I mean, and honestly, like what story has he ever done that has that type of world building either? You know, like we had joked around last year when he was talking about adapting It Chapter 2 and about, oh God, it's just really hard to like bring these characters together. I'm like, how is it hard? You literally have the blueprint like in the book to get these characters together. So
yeah. And the structure is like actually fairly easy.
Yeah.
Like it's hard to bring them together. Like, you know, you have the blueprint, but then it's not like the structure is complicated. They're all called back. You know what I mean? It's not that hard. And so,
Vampires are going to be all CGI. Yep. And just like,
exactly. And I guess that's just the bummer is I really want, I want there to be a lot of personality and character to this. And if I have a problem with Dauberman's work, it's that he just doesn't, his writing is very, by the numbers and very, you know, beat driven. And I think about, you know, I really liked Annabelle Creation, but I think a lot of that had to do with the directing, which was mm-hmm. by David Sandberg, who did Shazam. He just did Shazam. And I thought Annabelle Creation was really well directed. The script is, you know, it's boilerplate. It's yeah. whatever. It's taken out of kind of the modern horror playbook. And so, and I guess this is, you know, something that we can touch on more in a little bit, but I guess for me, I guess my Dauberman real test will be with It Chapter Two, because yeah. the first movie, I feel like we gave it a lot of grace. And I think some of the best parts of it came from Cary Fukunaga's script, uh-huh. you know, that we had.
Well, and if you want to talk about slick studio horror, like I feel like my opinion of It Chapter One has sort of fallen the more times I watch it, because it is sort of, it's got the same sort of slick yeah. slickness to it. And the virtues that it does have come from the surreality of the source material and the script, as you were saying.
Yeah, well, I feel like they did the characters right, but I feel like a lot of that probably came from Cary Fukunaga's draft. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm curious about is if Dauberman handled this script on his own. So I'm curious if, you know, can he pull this off? And you know, that's – and I guess, like, The Nun is one thing, but can he pull off a King property on his own, which we haven't seen him do yet, you know? No. So that's – you know, I mean, you can write your Conjuring movies, whatever, but if you can do something really good with It Chapter 2, if I watch this and I'm like, hey, the script is actually really strong, then maybe I can be a little more excited about Salem's Lot. But, you know, like – and Tommyknockers with Juan, like, I don't know. The thing is, I'm not that invested in that book, and that's the thing is I like that book more than the rest of the pod, but at the same time, I'm not expecting – I just want some nice campiness from it. And so I don't really care what they do with it. I'm just excited to see whatever they do with it. Whereas Salem's Lot is obviously probably in my top 3-4 King books. And, you know, you want to see it – you want to see some justice done to it.
And it's also like – it's a very long and there's just expansive book. I mean, there's so much that happens into it. And I think that's one of the things we discussed in one of the last episodes, probably a few weeks ago, where you discussed that it probably would work better as a miniseries, you know, like this, yeah. There's just yeah. so much that's going on. And I think the idea that we've never really seen him work with such an expansive world is a concern. And also the fact that, like, I mean, I guess if he has the blueprint, and like you said, we're going to see with It Chapter Two with how he's going to handle source material. Awesome. I'm very excited to see how that goes. But let's say he fumbles that, then I have no hope for this, because based on everything he leans upon when it comes to originality, it, as you were saying, it recycles the sort of stuff from the horror book. Like, I mean, there's so much, even with this recent, Conjuring entry, the Curse of La Llorona, like, it's literally just copy and paste horror yep. that they keep
That's
doing.
What I've heard.
And it's exhausting, you know, and I don't really want that from Salem's Lot. I mean, honestly, the stuff with Salem's Lot that's terrifying is the sort of atmosphere and the tension that you can kind of that King wires throughout all of the slower proceedings. And, you know, it's funny, we were watching Scream last night, my girlfriend and I, and, you know, there's just like one little scene where she's like on her porch on the phone, and you see like this like gorgeous, expansive California, you know, layout in this land. And she was remarking, like, you know, you never really see that in horror movies anymore nowadays, or like modern horror movies, where you just kind of like sit with the world a little bit and yeah. just kind of enjoy yeah. it. And that's a huge part of Salem's Lot. Like, you need that. And a lot of the book is like Ben just like looking up at that house, the Marston house. And I don't yeah. know. I just,
you know, I agree 100%. I think what's interesting is, you know, you talk about the expansiveness of it. And when you talk about what's scary about Salem's Lot, I think it's learning the town, learning the characters, mm-hmm. and then sort of how one by one, they each kind of, you know, the town begins to change. We watch, like, you know, I always think of Dud, the trash guy, yeah. and sort of his transformation, which to me is like a real turning point in that book. But then once you get to the end, the way King structures it, it's just like all these short chapters and vignettes of various people that have been turned. And it's like, you know, the dominoes fall slowly at first, but then they fall like crazy, and you mm-hmm. need a lot of time to set that up to earn sort of the massive transformation of the town. And for me, if you focus strictly on sort of the Dracula core group of, you know, Ben Mears and Jimmy Cody and Danny and that whole crew, you miss something, you lose something, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, because that's the core story, but it's really about the larger community and the slow transformation and the slow deadening of this town, you know?
Well, when I read Salem's Lot for the first time, I remember being blown away that the word vampire doesn't come into the text until, I think it's at least after page 200. Like, we don't even get the word. And then, of course, the vampires themselves are subversions of the sophisticated Dracula-like vampires that are populating literature more than these, like, very monstrous, fright nighty types of vampires. So I'm hoping that maybe the monsters themselves will help to lend originality. I mean,
100 bucks says you could take the the poster of the nun or any screen grab of the nun and just put vampire fangs on it. Like, maybe you even Photoshop the ones that are in the Toby Hooper version.
It's Annabelle with vampire
fangs. And honestly, like, I've already been seeing, like, you know, it's, oh God, it's so funny you mentioned Annabelle again too. Cause like when I was sitting there waiting for the It trailer to drop, I was watching, I guess they have this new functionality on YouTube where you can just chat while things premiere. And yeah, I was watching people's reactions, and someone was just like, hope we see Annabelle in this. And I couldn't tell if that was a joke or if that's real, you know?
It'd be like Salem's Lot tagline, Annabelle's out for blood.
But it's like so absurd, like just exactly what you're saying, though. Like, I've heard the Curse of La Llorona, like they tied it into the Conjuring universe in the most, like, just by throwing one reference to another movie.
It's literally, you see a priest hold the doll walking into a monastery without them actually mentioning the like Annabelle the doll. He's just like holding it.
So lazy.
Like, I know.
That speaks to the modern audience in some ways too. Like, we need to train the audience to be different in just the sense that, like, a reference to another movie is not an Easter egg, or it's not something to get excited about. It's just like you can't connect a universe by just saying Annabelle exists within this universe. Like, that's like what we always bag on with the Dark Tower movie, where they're like, Cujo's in the Dark Tower movie, but what, you just see a fucking Saint Bernard on the street? Like, that's the thing that drives me crazy. Yeah. And it's like, if you're going to build out an expansive universe, like, fucking look at what Marvel did. You know what I mean? Those are like interlocking storylines that go throughout 22 movies and impact each other. You can't just build a universe because you make references to the other movies within them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like they should be impacting each other. But so that's why it's like, yeah, why don't they just fucking throw Annabelle in It Chapter 2? You know what I mean? It's like, why not?
To be fair, our guy is guilty of doing this in his books as well, a little bit.
Yeah,
sometimes.
But we can look at the overall Stephen King universe and say that it's a work of art. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That it's awesome. I mean, yeah, there are little references, but those are more just kind of like cutesy. Like, he's not. It's not like that's all he does to build his universe. So I don't know.
Well, I was always hoping that when we in Under the Dome that like Cujo managed to squeeze into the dome before it
this
comes
time,
down.
Cujo's in the dome.
Yeah, yeah, and maybe they could fight the corgi that's in that book. But
maybe the only way that they can get out of the dome is if Christine drives through.
Hey, get you that. Go get that Plymouth. You know, we'll get in the car.
Hey, there's a crazy guy with an axe shouting about Wendy trying to hack into the dome.
Well, hey, speaking of a crazy guy with an axe trying to crack into a dome, this is a very irregular, a seg, but King talked to Mick Garris, who directed The Shining, which also features a maniac with an axe. Oh, actually not an axe, but a mallet. But okay, that's a very, very coarse transition, and I apologize.
I approve.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Randall, you got to listen to this interview. This is a big interview because King never goes out and does anything. And B, he definitely doesn't really go out and do podcasts. So
no, when he gives interviews, it's usually just to Entertainment Weekly.
Yeah, so, it really is. It's kind of frustrating that way.
And it was funny because it was on Mick Garris's podcast and it sounded like it was, you know, our early episodes of Losers Club. Like, it was like the lowest quality ever. It was very funny, but it was an interesting interview. I wouldn't say that I learned too much or gleaned too much. Mm-hmm. I'd say that there's some interesting tidbits where King talks about the Stand reboot. He doesn't give away much at all, but he does say that he's happy that there's two extra hours, you know, because it's going to be, I guess it's going to operate instead of 6 hours. Or wait, how long was the original? Was it 8 hours or 6 hours? Like with commercials.
I want to say it was like around 6 hours, but I know that he was saying that because that there's cursing and there's a bigger, you know, they're going to be able to curse. They're going to be able to have violence. They're going to be able to have a bigger budget. It was kind of interesting to hear him talk about how, like they're going to have a little bit more flexibility in that respect. Yeah. It was 4 episodes originally. And it totals 366 minutes. So, okay. Yeah.
So So he said there was like 2 more hours that they were going to get to use, mm-hmm. which is just great. And then he talked about his son writing on it, and he sounded really positive about it. But of course, he's always positive about these things. And
he's just a positive guy.
He really is.
But like, so
I did love that you could hear, like, and I mentioned this on Twitter, but I love that you could hear his like house sounds, you know, you could like hear the wind chimes in the background. So I just imagine he was like drinking like iced tea, like on the porch or something like that.
Eating a mayonnaise and butter sandwich or whatever the fuck.
Gross. Yeah.
What else did he talked about the Institute a little bit. He didn't say much about it, but he, you know, he kind of talked about some of the general ideas about it and the idea of, you know, the front half and the back half, like of this Institute, and the idea that kids disappear once they go to the back half. And he was kind of just using that as a means to talk about other things. But
he said that, like, if you told him, you would have to kill him. And I know that's a joke, but there's a lot of like, I mean, we've had a lot of talk about this being like a sequel to The Shop of sorts. And I do wonder if this is actually like one of his like first like real in canon books in since God, what, like 1122 maybe, or revival. I mean, not even revival, but like it feels like this is going to be something that ties larger to King's Dominion than say like Mr. Mercedes or The Outsider.
Yeah. He said there's a lot of moving parts in the book, and that he kind of mentioned that it was a like a kind of a bigger ensemble. And I think he said it jumps around time a lot too, mm-hmm. which was interesting. So yeah, so it'll be interesting. It sounds like a very ambitious book compared to his last few. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think that should be great. I wanted him to kind of, I don't know, I was kind of hoping for a few more maybe fun behind the scenes of making The Stand, the miniseries bits, but they talked a little bit about casting. They talked about, you know, Gary Sinise and King was very, very, you know, happy with the casting, obviously. And they talked about Matt Frewer, like, nailing the audition mm-hmm. for Sandman. And like when he did that scene with Randall Flagg, like the tears in his eyes, like when he did all that, and they're, you know, they were bragging on that. And then also just like, they were so happy with Gary
Sinise for sure. Like, he calls out Gary specifically, because I think he was the only one that like King was really like adamant on.
Yeah. That was a good performance.
It really is a good performance. And it, even though we didn't get to see a little rock and roll from Gary Sinise, you know, but the one thing I really liked about that was just them talking about just kind of like the little inside baseball things. Like I really liked that. we kind of found this out on Postmortem from the week beforehand when he did, like, Mick Garris does this like Ask Mick Anything sort of thing. And he talked about how like, somebody asked about Don't Dream It's Over, the Crowded House song that plays over all the scenes from the apocalypse. And I guess in the script, King had written like for the Beach Boys, Fun, 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 which is like, what? I don't even know how that would have translated. But it was fun seeing him to like kind of relent and be like, you know what, that was a better choice, Mick. And it was beautiful. And it was just very cute. Like it felt like, you know, two old men that you get to kind of hear in a bar talking occasionally.
Yeah, I think that's King's morbid side coming out, and Mick was like, why don't we have a nice little moment of emotion here? So mm-hmm. That was kind of cool. And it was just neat to see, I don't know, to hear them banter, because obviously they've worked on so many projects together, and King is obviously very fond of him. And yeah, it was just cool to hear that little banter between them. And King talked a little bit about sort of the, you know, when he first wrote the book and sort of the political climate mm-hmm. that he was going on and things like that. So,
I also love how he kept calling him Mick, like regardless of the fact that they've been talking for 40 to 45 minutes. Like there's like little like personal inflections that he would add into this that you get a little bit more of Stephen King. Cause I honestly, other than hearing him talk at, you know, occasional, you know, appearances and whatnot, I don't really hear a lot of like interviews with him. So like having him, just knowing that he has that sort of personal touch where he just is going to say your name again and again was very, I don't know. I thought it was cute. I just thought it was really adorable, but
no, it was cool. It was a good, it's a good listen. I don't think it'll blow you away. It's not like it's like, goes really deep into any particular topic, but you know, it's a very sweet conversation, and it's fun to just kind of hear, those two.
I was bummed out. We did not hear Molly barking in the background. Bummed out about that. Like this dog is supposed to be this terror, you know, this was this thing of evil, and I didn't hear any barking. I really just wanted to hear barking and be like, Molly, shh. Like that would have made the whole interview for me.
I know. The only other thing I thought was fun was when he was talking about the Shining miniseries and mm-hmm. how people for telling him not to do it, because they're like, well, the movie's so iconic. And he goes, and he's like, fuck that movie. Like, he, or he goes, fuck Stanley Kubrick. Yeah. He's like, I'm gonna take the story that I wrote, you know?
Yeah.
And then he talked about, he's like, talk about them actually filming at the Overlook. And then they talked about him wearing all the prosthetics to play the dead band leader.
I like that they're saying like Pat Hingle was like a huge deal in the, yeah. Like, okay.
But for them, you know, it's like those old school dudes. I mean,
yeah.
It's a whole other world.
Yeah. Are any of us going to see him in, is it Minneapolis over the summer?
It's this month. So, it's coming up really soon. I've molded over because I think it would be really fun to see him live. You know, when we talked to Tanana Reeve-Dhu, she was talking about like rocking out with him. And I was like, I kind of want to see this in person. Like videos aren't going to do it justice. I need to see him in like the flesh to do this. So there's, I'm still debating because it's only a drive away. Like I can, you know, get in there and hop over the fence or something and be like, Steven, come here, and just, you know, get tackled. But
wait, is it Minneapolis?
I think so. Yeah.
Yes. Minneapolis is still really far though.
I know. It's a really long fucking drive. I did that for my bachelor party, and it just was the long, like, I remember we finally got there and all of us were too tired to do anything because it was like 5 hours of nothing.
Well, all right. Should we talk about the main event?
Let's do this. We're going to be talking about It Chapter 2 teaser trailer. Let's just put this is a spoiler alert, spoiler, spoiler, spoiler. We are going to be talking about the book. We're going to be talking about tidbits that, you know, will explain scenes in the trailer. I'm putting huge red letters and spoilers on my takeaways piece that I'm doing for Consequence of Sound because of that. And because there's a lot to be spoiled in this trailer. So if you don't want to know anything that goes on in this movie, A, you probably shouldn't be watching the trailer anyway. And B, definitely don't listen to this conversation that we're going to be having right now.
It's me. The Losers Club has officially begun.
We can do this, but we have to stick together.
Okay, who wants to kick this off?
Well, I guess I'm curious, like, what was maybe a good way to kick it off is like, what was your first reaction upon watching it? Like, when it finished, how did you feel? Mel, why don't you start?
Yeah.
I like the structure of it. I like we open with a drawn out actual full, well, not full, but a slightly cut scene with Beverly and Mrs. Kirsch. And then once we know what we're about, we get a couple abrupt flashes and that's it.
Yeah.
I'm into that as a trailer structure.
I agree. I'll say the thing is, like, at first I was like, I was texting with you, Mike, and everybody, and I was a little bit like, man, what are they doing showing a whole scene here? But along the same lines, I'll say that it really felt fresh just in that the trailer structure, because I feel like trailers have really become sort of repetitive these days. Like they kind of hit the same big drum beats and stings and move at kind of a similar pace. So it was actually kind of an interesting slower trailer.
Slower is a good key word. Like I was actually surprised, like I think about maybe a minute in when Bev is just kind of standing there in the living room and it's literally silent for 5 seconds. And I'm like, this is a trailer. Like that's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Well, it reminds
me. That's why I was so mad over text when I was like, why don't they fully commit to this? Why are they flashing back to child Bev and ruining the whole conceit of this as a slow burn, full scene, live in the moment trailer? So I wish they had committed to it more fully.
Well, it just makes me think of like when I do write up trailers, like when I wrote up like, you know, Spider-Man Far From Home trailer, or like when I wrote up the Ari Aster's Midsommar trailer, you know, they do those things where it's just like boom, 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 with all these different images. And you're like sitting there pausing and pausing and pausing and trying to get a look at what that one flash image is, you know, so you can get some kind of thing. And there was some of that at the end of this trailer, but it was kind of neat to just kind of be able to live in a scene for a little bit. And so while at the one, you know, and a lot of our viewers, I was reading a lot of the Instagram comments on it, and a lot of viewers were a little bit annoyed at this idea of like, you know, this could feel like a spoiler, you know, like this whole scene. And I mean, but the thing is, the trailers are spoilers nowadays. I've just come to accept that. Like,
yeah, oh, totally.
Like, totally. So entire too much. And so I kind of enjoyed that they just kind of lived in this one scene. And I'd say that scene was a good choice, because not only is it a beloved scene in the book and one of the scarier scenes of the adult section of the book, it's also one of the more effective parts of the miniseries. Like, because the second part of the miniseries is pretty rough, I think we can all agree. Yeah. But the most effective one is the Mrs. Kirsch scene, and I still find it effective to this day. And so I'll say that I thought this was a good one to lead with, and I thought that it did a nice job of showing both how it was, you know, still adhering to and honoring the book, but it also had its own like Andy Muschietti touches in there, which
go for it.
I was going to say, on second watch, there are so many little, I don't know, modern horror leaning jump scary parts in the Mrs. Kirsch scene that I really missed on first watch, like her head peeking out from the door frame.
That scared me. That admittedly got me, I will say.
I'm a little upset that they did the whole like you already know something is so totally wrong when she like squirms and runs in the background. I wish there had been a slower build.
Yeah.
And if you want to talk about copy pasting from earlier, like, I feel like this theme of isn't it creepy when old people are running around naked is like drawn directly from both The Visit and Hereditary.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
That's a good point.
Yeah. I saw a lot of The Visit in comments and tweets today. And I think that the thing that does, you know, give me a little fear still is that they are leaning on those, like, for those fast sort of jumps, you know, and the only thing that is, you know, giving me solace is the fact that there's a lot of peripheral horror in this trailer and even beyond this scene. But of the peripheral horror you do get in this scene is pretty effective. Like you had mentioned, like when she kind of appears along, you know, alongside the line, I was actually getting screen grabs for this feature I'm working on, and I just had not seen that.
Right.
And all of a sudden, as I'm like readying the screen grab, her face comes around the corner. I was like, oh my God. And I like literally screamed out loud in my room, and that just never happens for me. So like, if they can continue to like kind of lean on that peripheral horror in this movie, then I'll enjoy it a little bit more in terms of the horror factor.
Yeah, especially because, you know, if there's one thing I think we all, when it comes to the original movie, we were annoyed by the CGI, definitely. That was something that really bugged us. And I think it was also sort of the fast moving, like screaming horror, you know, which is what happens at the end of this trailer. And so I guess like my hope is that is obviously we're still going to get some of that. And that's very much a Muschietti thing. If you watch Mama, he does similar bits in that. But I'm just hoping that there is maybe sort of a more eerie, more dread-inducing kind of horror. Because, I think that for me was Mrs. Kirsch peeking around the corner was when I first watched it. I was like you, Mike, in that I caught it out of the corner of my eye, and I wasn't sure what I'd seen at first. And my only thing is like, man, imagine if you saw that in the theater and you couldn't rewind it and you just had to sit with it a little bit, you know? Like
This is such a huge opportunity to differentiate itself from the first movie in terms of the type of scares. If we go from what scares a child and how children perceive things that they're afraid of to a more adult zone, like even if I didn't fully love the choices that were made, I would be struck dumb in admiration if they really did something totally different from the first one. Like, I just think that it's such a good opportunity, and I'm not convinced that they're going to do it, but I'm really hopeful.
Because when you think about like a studio saying, hey, do what you did in the first one, because that made money, you know what I mean? So the hope is that they would stylistically differentiate it, because there is some of that in the book too. And
it's like the best part when things get a little grimmer and just different as adults. Like, I love that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How much time do you think they're really going to take before the losers all get together?
I mean, it depends on how long the movie is. Like, if I see that it has like a 2.5 hour running time, then maybe
it's going to be long. It's going to be at least as long as the first one.
How long was the first one?
It was pretty long.
I think it was around two hours and 10 minutes. Let me look real quick.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, I figured that, I don't know. I figured they maybe give them 30 minutes separate, 30 to 40 minutes probably. I would imagine. And then
it was 135 minutes. Wow.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And so I hope that they give it a little bit of time, because I think, you know, if they want us to care about the lives they have outside of Derry, I mean, if they want us to care about Audra, which I think is a, you know, the book does a pretty decent job of it, but the miniseries did not. No. And if they, you know,
they might cut Audra. I wouldn't be surprised if she's not in this at all.
No, she's in. They cast her.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. The actress who, from Teeth, the actress from Teeth is going to, Jess Weixler. She's going to be in it. So,
and they cast a guy to play Beverly's husband, right?
Tom,
I believe mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, Tom's cast also. Will Beinbrink is playing him. And honestly, Will Beinbrink.
I hope that they lean into those storylines, because, you know, they kind of excise them a lot in the miniseries. And I think that they can be really effective. I love the idea of the outsiders coming in mm-hmm. and being like interwoven into Pennywise's sort of web. You know, that's very interesting to me.
Well, we definitely see the bruises on Bev's arms. So she's been Tom. That's obviously going to be attributed to Tom. So
that's a good point. I didn't catch that when I watched it. You had mentioned that you can see bruises on her,
which is creepy as hell. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if they spent some time with, you know, her in Chicago, or wherever they change it to. But I mean, that's my thing, is like, those scenes, they happen early on in the book, and they're really key, because you really do get into the characters and gets insight into the characters. And I think if Dauberman's smart, he'll have leaned on that for this screenplay to kind of, because I mean, honestly, there are the same characters, but they're not really, you know.
No, and I hope we open with Stan and his demise. I hope we open with, as a direct contrast to the weirdness of Georgie, mm-hmm. like this more adult, controlled, weird, dramatic thing. Like, I think that would be great.
Yeah. I think it's going to be between Stan and Adrian Mellon, I would imagine. Right.
Yeah. 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 That's a good point. And they started the miniseries mm-hmm. with Stan, and I believe the book starts with Stan, or at least somewhere around there. So I could be wrong, but so they might switch it up by doing the Adrian Mellon story, which I can foresee being, because it's one of the scariest parts of the book, and I can foresee it being really terrifying here. Hope, and then it's just wild that they have Xavier Dolan, who's like, you know, Wunderkind, you know,
yeah.
He's like 27 and he's like made like 4 movies that have all been critically acclaimed, but he still acts. And so, yeah, I think it's kind of neat that he's in this movie, and I'm curious to see how they're going to manifest that character. We don't get any glimpses of that. Although I think Justin said that we see the bridge, right?
We do. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause we see all the balloons coming out from under the bridge, right?
Yeah. We definitely are going to have that scene. They've cast bullies with the Adrian Mellon, sequence. And they have Don Haggerty, they cast Taylor Frey as Don Haggerty, which is Adrian's boyfriend. So, they're going to do that whole sequence. And it seems as if they're taking, you know, based on this trailer, it seems as if they're going to have a lot of more side stories with the kids too, still, you know, to kind of fill in the gaps.
Yeah. Which I'm really curious about. Like, I wonder if it's just going to be more glimpses, or if we're actually going to spend any like meaningful time, because, you know, ostensibly we have seen the full journey played out there, but some of the glimpses we get to the kids, we see obviously the reflections in the window, which I think is going to more so be a, you know, when everybody's gathered together and they see them all together. But then we also see like a moment of intimacy between, young Bill and young,
Bev,
which is something that I don't believe we saw in the first movie. So I feel like that's really interesting. And I wonder like what sort of gaps they're going to try to fill in there. I mean, obviously there's a lot of Stan content that, that, you know, we get in the book that, is delivered later in the book. So I wonder mm-hmm. if they're gonna get into any of that, which would be really interesting to me.
Because isn't Stan in the book involved also with the bird as well, or whatever happens at the watering, mm-hmm. or the water plant? Like so that could, you know, be a scene that he has. I mean, and I do wonder if there's just so much you can do with these adults, mm-hmm. because they are really just windows to the past. So if anything that they didn't get from the first one, they could easily just go mine back in the other one. And one thing that, you know, Caffrey pointed out in the text was that it appears as if they are going to be using some stuff that they didn't use in the first one. And one of the things that's really kind of jarring is, at least with Pennywise, is, you know, in the trailer we see Bill Skarsgård like tearing off his face.
Yeah.
You know, and that ties into the portrait of, you know, Pennywise the Dancing Clown. And, you know, back in 2017, Bill Skarsgård said that, you know, this is what he told Vulture. He said, there was a scene we shot that was a flashback from the 1600s before Pennywise was Pennywise. The scene turned out really, really disturbing, and I'm not the clown. I look more like myself. It's very disturbing and sort of a backstory for what it is or where the Pennywise came from. That might be worth something exploring in the second one. The idea is the it entity was dormant for thousands and thousands of years. The flashback scene hints on that. And he says that Variety notes that a previous draft of the film does include a colonial set sequence where it devours a child. So there could
love
be,
that.
You know, right? So I'm wondering if, like, given the fact that we see, you know, the portrait that's in Kirsch's house, and then also that scene, I think we're going to probably get a lot of that sort of context.
I definitely think so. And that was a really, and you know, that was a really effective part of the book for me. I know that when we did our episodes, I talked at length about the Kirsch sequence and how creepy it is, you know, once her voice starts shifting and the accent comes out and we get in this, she says fodder, you know, F-A-D-R. And then, there is that emphasis of, like, you know, my father, this, and then the photo of the Pennywise dancing clown and all that stuff. And then, and we get that. And what was the name? Do we remember the name of the clown? Like that we get in the book?
It's Bob,
like
Gray.
Bob Gray, Robert Gray.
Like, yeah. Like, and I don't know if we're going to get that in this, but it's the same sort of thing where we get these glimpses of the idea that Pennywise was once, you know, it's not like its natural form is this clown. Where did the clown come from? And we get hints of it in the book. And then I think we're getting hints of it in this trailer. And that, to me, especially combined with that shot of him pulling the, you know, the clown makeup off or whatever, that, excuse me, that, that to me is a very exciting thing that they could do.
And because he's right there. He's palpable. Yeah. Like, I mean, you know.
Did you guys see any of the headlines that were like, we meet Pennywise's weird daughter in this trailer, as if she's like a separate canonical character?
No.
Well, they do make it sound like that. Like in the, like if you haven't read the book, you know,
right.
I feel like that is what you would think. Although I don't remember, is that like, yeah, I guess that is how it is in the book too. It is a curious thing that she leans so hard into the idea of being Pennywise's daughter, but then you also just say, well, is that what Pennywise is doing to get under Bev's skin, you know, because father-daughter relationship.
That's what I always took it as. I never really took it as literal. I mean, honestly, anything
she
backstory,
literally turns into Pennywise by the end of it in the book. Right.
But does she do that in the movie? Like, are they going to toy with it a little bit? I'm not saying she's like a separate character, but in the book, we actually, and in the miniseries, we actually watch her transform into Pennywise.
Because in the book, it's all in Mike's, you know, historical photos that his father has, where you actually even see some of the clown stuff. Like, I don't even remember that being in the Kirsch house or the quote unquote Kirsch house. Do you?
No, it's not.
You get the Robert Gray, there's a dresser that has the initials like BG or RG in it. Mm-hmm. So there is that connection, but I don't remember there being photos at all.
Which is really creepy, the name Bob Gray, when you actually think of it, because, you know, Albert Fish was like his pseudonym.
Was it?
Mm-hmm. And he was like the child killer and all, which is really...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's really like kind of eerie. Like he used to call himself by the name like Robert Gray. So it's...
And he would eat children too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
So maybe I wonder if he's trying to do some sort of historical fiction there, you know, where like, hey, this is actually, you know, it was really Pennywise the whole time that was killing all these kids.
Fascinating. And so let's talk a little bit while we're on Kirsch a little bit. You know, what do you think we're seeing when she opens up her shirt and we see sort of the wounds on her chest? Like, what is that getting
at? Well, did you notice what's on her shirt?
No, I missed it.
They're birds on a wire.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know how much to take from that. I mean, it could be either a reference to the bird that Hanlon sees later on, or it could be the reference to the sparrows that are in Castle Rock for Dark Half.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, or it could just be a reference to Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, a great popcorn classic.
Or Stan using the bird book to defeat Pennywise initially.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. That's a good one.
Yeah, so I think that's definitely a deliberate decision for sure. But I don't know. The sores are weird. I mean, what's really eerie is that right before that you see six flies for six losers.
Yeah. I noticed some of our commenters pointing that out. Yeah, I figure, I don't know if there was any meaning to it. I guess it just harkens back to the book where she starts to sort of like depreciate sort mm-hmm. of in front, like just starts to rot in front of Bev. And so
has anyone seen The Faculty?
Oh yeah. John Stewart.
Yeah. Well, do you remember when that scene where like the old lady like can't handle being abducted or, you know, assumed by the aliens because her body's too frail and can't handle the dehydration? It like reminded me of that sequence for some reason.
No, actually that makes total sense. Yeah.
It reminds me of Eddie's leper too. Like it looks mm-hmm. similar to what's going on his skin.
Really. Yeah, that's really neat.
Or it could even be like, you know, leftover wounds from the losers the first time. Like it's a sensitive spot for Pennywise.
Yeah. I thought it was really creepy that, maybe this is just stupid of me, but I thought it was eerie that the postcard still has blood on it, considering the blood isn't really supposed to be there, you know? And like, it's you would think that like if Pennywise was defeated, maybe the blood would go away finally, but it, you know, it's still on the postcard. It's still stained.
I was a little, confused that they didn't show us the gross tea, the blood tea.
Oh, the shit water in the book.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Sorry. It's shit.
I do wonder if like how much more of that scene we'll get, you know, once we actually watch it. But yeah, I do want to talk a little bit about sort of naked Mrs. Kirsch and that whole thing, because while I found the peeking around the corner to be really spooky, you know, once I think when she mentioned, she's like, oh, he was a dancing clown, or maybe you see dancing on the clown photo, I can't remember, but she like dances in the kitchen foyer or whatever, like mm-hmm. behind him. And that to me was it's creepy, but it's also a little silly. Like, you know, it's where I kind of get to that point where I don't want my ghost to be too whimsical.
Yeah. Well, it's like, why? I mean, I guess she's supposed to be changing or shaking up or something like that, but it's just played for like, isn't this creepy? You know?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's lazy.
Yeah. Where like it works to me on sort of that basic visceral level, but it's one of those things where you think about it a little bit, and it's like when you see her at the end of the hallway, which is, you know, the shot of her at the end of the hallway is creepy enough, but then you have to do like this little, like, you know, quick shake and then sort of transform a little bit. And it's kind of like
the old quick shake.
Yeah. The old quick shake, you know, it was just a little bit weird, but, it's funny because I've always been freaked out by the idea of something staring at you around a corner. It's mm-hmm. like something that goes way back to me. Do you guys remember the MTV show Fear?
Yes.
Where they would see how long they could stay in like haunted places, like mm-hmm. before they died, and they would wear these camera apparatuses that at the time were like really cut out.
Yeah. And they always had Godsmack playing in the beginning and the ending.
They did. But I do remember there was one episode where they were like getting the history of this abandoned hospital, and they were talking to like a janitor that worked there, and he was like, yeah, you know, I just remember I would be cleaning in this area, and I would always think that there was something staring at me from around the corner of this hallway, and every time I would look, I feel like for a split second I would see it, and then it would be gone, and then I would turn away and see it out of the corner of my eye again, that something was staring at me around the wall, and I turn and it would be gone again. And that to me was so scary.
Oh, like, yeah. I mean, my hair is standing up right now just thinking about that.
Yeah.
Especially since I'm alone in here, but
and like that to me is so freaky. And so that's why I think I found that section freaky. And also because her movements, you know, like, they get a little bit silly when you see her sort of dancing across, but like there is also sort of this jittery sort of live movement that is so divorced from the old woman persona that you see even when she's peeking, that I find really unnerving.
Well, it's also there's this playfulness to it in the peeking around that's really creepy, like being like, ooh, is she buying it? That kind of scares me a little bit, but also if you lean too hard in that, it becomes a little too cute. The thing that the body walking across reminded me of is, have you ever seen The Sentinel? It's a really old 70s horror movie, but it's a great horror movie, but there's a great scene where, I'm actually going to spoil it, but there's a great scene where like a door opens and this just pale white body just walks across. It almost reminds me of a little bit of like Exorcist 3 too. That scene definitely like kind of conjured up those fears, no pun intended, but at the same time, like, yeah, it's just, there's something about it that looks a little too fake. Like the problem I have with The Conjuring horror is that most of the time I just assume it's CGI horror because it looks so elaborate and crazy and fantastical, so that when there actually is practical effects, I wonder, like, or when there actually are practical effects, I do like, are they? Like, I don't really know. Like, I mean, it seems so like...
When it's usually a mix anyway, like it's never 100% practical.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I hope that the CGI is better in this one than in the first one, because yeah. I think that's what we struggled with was some of the, not so graceful CGI. And
I just the idea that like you'd have when we watch Castle Rock and, you know, Bill Skarsgård, who's just sitting there, is far more terrifying as himself than anything he does in it.
God, it's so true. Horror movies are afraid of stillness these days. It's mm-hmm. not good.
Yeah.
Well, at least coming from someone who just watched The Cell and won't shut up about it. The Cell is so good.
I love The Cell.
We should do a Cell cast sometime because I love The Cell a lot. I haven't seen it in years, but I loved it when I was a kid.
I love Vince Vaughn's role in that.
In it. It's great.
Do you like Vince Vaughn in it?
Yeah. He's just kind of like this periphery character. And whenever he appears, he's still doing that serious, like, Clay Pigeons style of acting that he was doing at the time.
Yeah, he hasn't done no Wedding Crashers and stuff yet. So.
Yeah. But there's a lot of stuff in this one trailer that I'm legitimately shocked they were able to put so much in here. Do you want me to run down a few things that I noticed?
Yeah, do it.
Okay,
do it.
So basically, like right after the whole curse scene, we get glimpses of the adults, which, by the way, I think the adults look perfect in terms of the casting. Yeah. But we find
Ben
out...
Ben is really hunky, though.
Oh, I know. That's a little... That's the one
Ben
that's...
Ben is so hot. Like, let's think about
he's
it. Like,
too hot. Let's think about it.
Ben growing up to be John Ritter, like, okay, I can do that. Mm-hmm. You know, like, John Ritter's hot, but he's also a normal man. Whoever is playing Ben, I forget his name.
J. Ryan.
He is the hottest person I've ever seen.
I know. He's so gorgeous. And I just can't buy that. Like, I mean, look, Jerry O'Connell went from Vern to Jerry O'Connell. So, yeah. But at the same time, come on.
Like, come on. Anyways, okay, continue.
So they're all walking around, which walking tours, isn't that that's a big part of the book? So that's, we definitely see that they're going to be doing that. And I'm actually really excited, and I hope it's not just a montage and that you actually get some sort of, extended patient moments as they're going around.
Yeah, it seems like Richie is alone for the Paul Bunyan moment. Yeah. So I'm hopeful as well.
Yeah, I love that. But we get to see the losers at the Jade. So seems as if Ben...
That's happening.
That's going to happen. Can't wait. We get Ben, Bev, and I believe it was... who was the third one that's in that scene with her? Ben, Bev, and Richie. Yeah, and I think who's that looking at the fish tank? I think it's Eddie, Bill, and Mike. Yeah. So it seems like we're gonna have split groups in that sense when they first get there, which I think is actually true to the original book too. That's good. We get a glimpse of Georgie. Hey there. Says hi to Bill. What I love is that when you get a glimpse of the past, when all the kids are on the bicycles, Richie Tozier, aka Finn Wolfhard, aka Mike from Stranger Things, Mike Wheeler, aka lead singer of Calpurnia, is wearing like a Screaming Hand skate shirt, which I thought was makes him seem a little cool.
Nice.
You had mentioned, Mel, the scene with Richie seeing Paul Bunyan. If you look behind him, everyone's also staring at Paul Bunyan. And in frozen terror in a way, or like they seems like as if they're frozen, kind of like the shots that we had in the first one where you could see like the librarian doing that weird grin.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
So I thought it was like, they almost looked like they were arrayed for like that concert that is mentioned in the book. Mm. Like they're all there for a festival of something. And then there's like an amusement park later.
Oh yeah. So the amusement park. That was really interesting.
Yeah. And that's what's really weird, because not only do you see the amusement park that's at night and you assume that, well, okay, well that's where Adrian Mellon's going to be. But then you later see an older Bill, James McAvoy, AKA Charles X, AKA the Beast. he's running through the fair, you know.
Sorry, that's not Beast from X-Men. Again, he is Xavier in X-Men. He's
Xavier in X-Men.
Split.
But we are talking about Beast and Split. Yeah, yeah. I can't think of any other IPs that he's attached to. Oh, yeah, he's in Atomic Blonde. But anyway, so he's running through the fair. So I assume that there's going to be some sort of epic thing that happens at the fair.
Yeah.
You know? we get the hundreds of balloons that we mentioned. So that's under the bridge. And it seems as if Mike Hanlon's at the scene because he's picking up one of the balloons with the string on it.
Yeah, that's popped. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's on the book, though.
Right? I don't remember that now.
So that's kind of interesting that he's going to be that involved there. But
we know that he stayed in Derry as a drug addict.
Oh, yeah. We don't see any evidence of
that.
He's
looking
here.
Pretty good in the trailer.
Yeah, he's looking great.
I will say when they're all like disheveled staring there at the end and they see the reflection, which is clearly the ending of the movie because, spoiler alert, Eddie's not there. They all look really disheveled in ways that, you know, that kind of go into kind of feed into our fears or that no, you know, diminish our fears of like, are they all just going to look really too hot? You know, like even, you know, even because Isaiah Mustafa is gorgeous. Like, I mean, he's just an absolutely gorgeous
man.
They're
all hot. They're all really hot.
But they don't look too hot, I don't feel like, in this.
They look too hot for me.
I don't know. Like, if you look at Isaiah again, it seems like he put on some weight for this movie, which, because, you know, those Old Spice commercials, he looks like he's chiseled from God. And in this one, he kind of has, like the baby fat that Chosen Jacobs has.
They're like still very schlubby hot instead of normal people like the mini.
Well, let's just say that, you know, Bill Hader doesn't look like he has his shit together like he does in Barry, like in terms of his haircut.
Yeah, let's just say I would fuck both in.
Oh, I would absolutely sleep with Bill Hader. But all right, so we get to see that Paul Bunyan's back. I don't know how they're going to handle that. I mean, we've seen behind the scenes footage of Pennywise with the balloons. So that's an actual real shot with wire work, which I appreciate.
It looks awesome. Yeah.
So that looks great. And that shot is amazing. We see the aforementioned shot of him peeling off the face. So I think that, you know, that kind of doubles down and then possibly on the theory that we're going to get the origin story. There is the shot of Bev and Bill kissing, which means that Bill's going to be cheating on Andra. right after that, we get two really, really revelatory moments. One, you get to pretty much see Eddie's, like, quote unquote, sacrifice, because he goes and goes to strike something green. Everything's glowing.
And they're
green.
Like in the sewers.
Yeah.
It's implied.
But you know who else is also, you know who else is in the sewer?
Who, Mike?
Yeah. Mike. Mike Hanlon. Because if you recall in the book, he doesn't go to the sewer. He gets injured at the library.
Oh,
he gets left behind in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, like, what are they going to change that?
Right?
I haven't seen Bowers yet.
No Bowers yet, and he better show up.
Oh, I think he's absolutely going to show up.
I know he does, because we saw the set photo where he was getting in the car with Belch. So.
Oh, is that? Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Oh wow.
So that's
you mean LeBray? Whatever.
LeBray. Yeah. Roland LeBay.
LeBay. LeBay. I think it'll be Christine. I hope it's Christine.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
That was like several months ago, but I remember that there was a leaked shot of
I did not know that.
Into the car, so.
So they are going to do like the ghost thing again.
Which I'm too. I love that story.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. And they kind of allude to that in the first one with him like seeing the shit that's all on the TV and all.
I just hope it ends. I just hope it ends better, because even in the book, like, it's just kind of anticlimactic.
Oh, I
and
agree.
In the series, it really doesn't work, but I hope that they do a little bit more with Bowers. He's my boy.
Well, if you recall, based on even the conversations we have with Tom Lee Wallace and also with Andy Muschietti, like a couple years ago, they were really sort of like hesitant on the spider stuff. Like, so yeah. I imagine that this ending is going to have a totally different thing. However, one thing that we do see in this trailer, again, is a pretty major spoiler, is the ritual of Chud. They're all standing together in a circle and staring. Or it's chewed. I forgot. I just watched Chud on Shudder a few weeks ago. So
I always say Chud. I always get it wrong.
So the ritual of chewed. They show all of them in a circle, and then I have to imagine that's the ritual, right?
Well, I mean, it's broad enough that I feel like, you know, you don't know, but it probably is. But wasn't there some scene where they all stood and held hands like that in the first movie?
Yeah.
They might just be
could
that.
Be anything. I wonder if they're going to do the smokehouse and like see the origins, or
I hope they do.
They are definitely one of the scenes I just skipped over by accident was that we do see Pennywise jump out of a vent in what looks as if it's could be the old ironworks or whatever that building was that Mike said his parents had burned into, you know, burned down into. I'm hoping that's the scene with the bird. You know, I think it would be cool.
Think they're going to do the bird.
You don't think so?
Maybe. Maybe Mrs. Kirsch's shirt is a clue. I don't know.
I wonder.
Word.
Or unless that, you know, because in the first one we did get the Lego turtle that is supposed to be like kind of like a fun reference to Maturin. Like, I wonder if that's the only thing that we're going to get for the turtle, and that's the only thing we get for the birds, you know, like these little kind of Easter eggs.
Yeah.
But the
it
last...
It makes sense. Like, I'm glad they're not tackling the turtle, honestly. That's just a lot.
Could you imagine if they just threw it in there without any sort of context?
Yeah.
But they said that it was going to get really cosmic, right? Like,
yeah.
They said that they were going to go there with the Ritual of Chewed. Like, they said it's in the movie, so you never know. Like, they might try to weave it in a little bit.
They might. I mean, the idea, you know, Caffrey was texting that even just the idea that it has the Mifada has that hints of those cosmic origins also. So
yeah, which is neat.
You know, I think that I don't know how far they're going to go into it, though, because I can't imagine they want to really lift off the ground too much.
Right.
But the last thing is that there were two things, really. One is, we know Jessica Chastain recently talked about there's a scene that has like the most blood ever used in a horror movie. I guess that's always going to be debatable by the horror hounds. And every time it's mentioned on Twitter, someone goes dead alive. But either way, it seems as if... that's the scene where, you know, you see her drowning in what appears to be a pool of blood. But if you look closely, it's the school bathroom.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah, I have a side-by-side photo that I managed to see. Because I looked at it and was like, this doesn't look like her bathroom at home. And also wouldn't make any sense for her to be at her own home. So, like, where the hell is this? And then someone on Reddit had a really cool side-by-side shot. And I was like, it is the bathroom stall where she was in the beginning when she got all the trash like piled on her in the first one. So,
yeah. Interesting.
And then the last,
I'm sorry
is,
if you guys can hear my cat purring, by the way, he's on
I can't.
My lap. So let me just,
church
let me
cat?
Know and I'll push him off. Yeah. This is Church.
Aww,
he's here.
Church cat. And then the last is the kid, you know, the next unsuspecting kid that, Pennywise goes, gets before, you know, Super the Legend, It Chapter 2. So looks like we're going to get some kids' death here, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, this movie will probably contain child death.
Yeah.
This movie about a child-killing clown will probably have some.
She doesn't look that scared, you know. Maybe she asked for it.
Yeah, right. But again, Georgie didn't look too scared either. And I think we had this huge debate on the first episode or the second episode of their It book coverage of being like, what would the clown have to do to entice me, you know, to actually like not be scared and be like, what the fuck is this thing in a sewer?
There are so many fucking Pennywise storm drains in Iowa City that like, they really creep me out.
Yeah.
You can see right into them, into the gaping blackness. He's in there.
I have to say, I kind of liked the repetitive Pennywise clown laughter that was ringing throughout the latter half of the trailer. There was something about the repetitiveness of it that, and the artificialness of it that actually I thought was kind of effective.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, the slogan that is bookended by the laughter is the end of it, right? Like,
does it say that?
Yeah, it's like, I forget how it starts, but it's like, it's like witness the end of it.
Yeah.
And by it, I mean, they might mean the battle, but it kind of does sound like, okay, like they're going to kill it again. Like,
yeah.
Right.
What if they just make like, you know, Warner Brothers, like, look, it made so much money. Let's just keep making sequels, baby. And they like, you know, we just keep hiring newer, you know, older and older, you know, cast members. And then they finally do a prequel and then they do like a spinoff movie. I mean, I don't, given the amount of money that this movie is going to make, I wouldn't put it past them to do some sort of prequel thing.
In Chapter 7.
That would be great. It would be like the first bit of like actual new material.
That's true. That's true. I mean,
September 6th is really soon, you guys.
I know. What about the lack of Stan?
Wait, what?
What about the lack of Stan here? I mean, he is going to be dead, but it is kind of weird that we see him as a kid, like all the way in the back, but it's kind of weird that we don't see him at all in this.
Well, he's only in one scene.
Yeah.
Please God tell me they're not going to try to do the his head in a fridge scene like they did in the miniseries and in the book. That's the worst shit.
Yeah. Actually, that's a good point. What are some things in the miniseries other than that, like, that you are worried that they might actually bring into this?
I guess, yeah. Number one for me is Stan's head in the fridge thing. I hope that once Stan's dead, they just leave him be.
Yeah.
I just don't want it.
Yeah.
I hope that they don't. I remember Eddie, well, this is from the book, but Eddie's like baseball flashback.
Oh, yeah.
It's really, that was not one of our...
Do you think Myra the Hog will be...
Oh, God. Just let him be, live on it. Like, because then in the miniseries, you had like his overbearing mother who he lived with. So just let Eddie be like a, let him live on his own.
You know, you know, what seems weird that I just saw right now. Because that, one of my things was going to be like, I want a better Audra, because I thought that whole sequence and stuff in the miniseries was just awful. But I actually really like Jess Weixler, but honestly, she won and beat out Julianne Moore, Hayley Atwell, and Claire Danes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wait, for this role?
Yeah.
Julianne Moore?
Isn't that weird? It says Julianne Moore. On the casting of Audra, Julianne Moore, Hayley Atwell, and Claire Danes were originally considered for the role.
Wow.
I can't imagine Julianne Moore in like being a supportive role that low.
I know.
That would be so wild to me. Yeah. Hey, King's Dominion, she played, Margaret White. So,
and she's playing, she's in Lacey's Story.
Yeah, that's true. So
she was Carrie's mom in the remake.
Yeah. Margaret, good old Margie White. Right.
Yeah.
So how about, I mean, Claire Danes would have been weird too. But, I mean, it's just too big. They're too big of stars for this role. I mean,
right. Hayley Atwell, I know that name. She was in she's like the Captain America's wife, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's all I know from.
So, yeah, well, that's that. I mean, I'm excited.
Pretty good breakdown, Mike.
I think this was pretty good. Yeah. Now I have to go type it all out and put it into a doc, but I'm still very cautious. I think I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, I'd say I'm cautiously optimistic. I don't know. If it were up to me, there would be no more trailers, but you know, there's probably going to be at least two more. And they're going to just keep revealing more and more. And cause that's just how it is these days. And I wish that it could stay more secretive, but you know, as part of this pod and just in our jobs, we have to keep watching them. So like, if it were up to me, I'd be like, I don't want to watch anymore. I just want to go see the movie. But you know, based on this trailer, I think, because I think that, you know, and Justo especially feels this way, which is just, you know, expectations are fairly low because we're not sure how much we trust the talent behind this, because I think that it was nice having Cary Fukunaga as sort of a, you know, an early guiding hand with the first movie. And I think Andy Muschietti is talent, but I'm not sure I fully trust him with this huge property. And then Dauberman, obviously, we're a little bit jaded with. So we'll see. But the cast is great. You know, this footage looks pretty good so far. There's some really striking shots. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love that shot of Pennywise over the Paul Bunyan statue. So, you know, I think that there's a lot to be optimistic about. And, you know, sign me up.
What about you, Mel?
I'm just cautious. Mm-hmm. I feel so burned. Like, feel burned by Pet Sematary most recently. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm very willing to be surprised. It's not like I'm not going to go see it, you know?
Right.
But even the stuff that I liked in this trailer on rewatch, I was like, oh no, they did do something to kind of like poke a hole in that. Oh, they did do something to poke a hole in that other thing. Like, yeah, I don't know. I think it's going to suffer from what we're predicting it will suffer from. But I'm very open to being proven wrong. Please prove me wrong.
It's interesting you mentioned the Pet Sematary thing, because I've been thinking about that a lot lately. Like, doesn't that feel like it already came out like 4 months ago?
Yeah. God, I hated that movie.
Yeah, I mean, I've sat on it a little bit more, and there are still aspects of it I really do like, and I appreciate some of the stuff that they're trying to do. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely like I need something like really solid in this King Renaissance right now to kind of bounce back a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, what else? What do we have coming out? Like,
we got Creepshow, which is really excited for.
Castle Rock season 2.
Mm-hmm.
And then Stand.
And then Stand until next year, probably.
Yeah, because they're still not done casting King's Head. So
no, and that's kind of interesting. You said that they have been casting. So there are people that have been cast. I'm saying it right here. I put it on Twitter. I want Devin Sawa as Stu Redman.
There's no way in hell. Remember that episode where we were supposed to talk about casting and all we did was say David Boreanaz?
Yeah. Watch that actually happen. If that happens, God.
Well, that's what I was saying. It's like CBS talent. Like, what are you going to get? I mean, I'm hoping that because it's CBS All Access and, you know, TV's cool now, that they can get some good people. But I'm still putting my money on David Boreanaz. I would much prefer Devin Sawa.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, oh, God, I'd love to have Sawa. And then also Dr. Sleep, which by the way, I loved in the interview when he talks about, like, you know, they called me up and they said, you know, they want Ewan McGregor as an old Danny Torrance. And I said, sure, go for it. When I was like, like, what if he insisted on someone from one of his shows that he likes on, like, what's that show that he likes? The Promise or whatever it is. That,
he wants Mark Paul Gosselaar from Passage.
Passage, that's what it is. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Titus Welliver from Bosch.
Or if they wanted Hugh Laurie at the height of Chance fame.
That is true.
Have happened.
Oh, shit.
Chance.
Hey, Hugh Laurie would be a great...
I agree. Glenn.
Which one?
Glenn.
Yeah, he would, actually. Damn.
Hell yeah.
I actually hope that happens. Well, we could probably have a casting session coming up soon with that, because I imagine that's going to be coming out within the next month or two.
Yeah, they'll probably announce some of the main names within the next 2 months, I would say.
Yeah. And main names is, you know, Maine is in the state of Maine. But...
For any.
Yeah. Well, I think that about wraps it up for this week. Thanks, everyone, for being able to take the time. And this is one of the earliest recordings we've done in a long time.
Yeah.
It's very nice. Yeah. It's very nice. We're going to be back next week when we talk about The Dark Half of the Movie. Yes, we've been hyping this movie episode for, I think, 3 or 4 weeks now. You've already had a chance to learn about the score before we talk about the movie. We're going to be back with that. And then we have a bunch of really fun episodes coming up. And in addition to what's the next book that we're going into? Four Past Midnight. Oof. Which episodes are you on again?
Library Policeman and Sundog, and I've been reading them this weekend.
Nice. And I'm on Secret Window.
Me too.
Yes.
Nice. With Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp.
I'm very excited to know that episode, because that's one of the few where I prefer the movie to the book. And even but the movie is derided, so...
Well, I'm excited to watch it again, too, because a fun little anecdote. I remember when it was out in theaters and I was so bored in South Florida, because I think it came out around spring break of college for me. And I just had nothing to do. Like, it's one of those nights where, like, you have all this time, nothing to do. And I remember my girlfriend at the time was like, "Ooh, there's this new Stephen King movie that's out." And I was like, "Oh, which one is that?" "Oh, Secret Window with Johnny Depp." And I remember thinking, like, I like Johnny Depp. I like Stephen King. I like horror movies. I have nothing to do. I have no interest in seeing this movie. And then I think we went and, like, I was dying. It was just so boring and not good, but whatever.
Yeah.
I think I saw it multiple times.
Were you a big fan?
I don't remember anything.
Do you have it on DVD?
I've talked about this on the podcast before. I only remember the last shot of the movie and how it spoiler alert, the movie ends. It's blackout on him biting into a big, juicy piece of corn.
Yes. Yep. That's all I remember, too, honestly. I think of corn all the time, even though it has nothing to
do
with
it. That's what I see before I fall asleep at night.
Do you have a poster that, like, you know, like when Blockbuster used to have those posters up, like, coming soon to DVD or video cassette, like, right. that you have, like, one of those old promotional posters that's, like, kind of torn at the bottom?
Oh, yeah, it's just stashed away.
Yeah.
Hanging up over the bed.
Yeah, you should. Oh, that would be great to get a Secret Window poster. I'm actually going to see if I could find one on eBay to get for the office. Like, why do you have a poster of this? Well, anyway, thank you so much. Please, please, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, you know, on Facebook. Give us a review on Twitter. You can't really do that, but just hit us up on Twitter. We really, really appreciate that. And we you know, what do you call it, Randall? Fresh content?
Fresh content on every channel. Yeah. We bring it.
Yeah, we got it all there, and especially on Instagram, where I unloaded all of the screenshots that I took of this the new 8 trailer. So we got a lot there, and we're going to be having a lot coming up, and including some opportunities that you're going to be wanting to know. But until then,
long days
and pleasant nights. I got some hot friends. I got some hot friends.
Consequence Podcast Network.